I hope people care about office hours. They should, because you're such a valuable resource in their education. Sure. But a lot of students probably think, but I'd rather get a latte.
This is A New Angle, and I'm your host, Justin Angle, marketing professor at the University of Montana. This podcast is my chance to speak with cool people doing awesome things in and around the great state of Montana. We are proudly underwritten by First Security Bank and Blackfoot Communications. All right, welcome back. Thanks for tuning in today. Super excited about this episode. It's kind of a geeky episode again for me. Last week, we geeked out with Kevin Cohane on all things brand, and this week, I geek out with Micah Larson on all things communications science. Micah is a communications scientist. She studies persuasion, and she's a practitioner of persuasion science through her firm, her consulting practice, Apis Communication Science. She was on an academic path and then stepped off that path to become a consultant to organizations and individuals trying to use the tools of psychology and persuasion and communications to better achieve the goals they're trying to achieve. So, super fun conversation with Micah. I admire her work. She's been a great collaborator and taught in our classes here at the College of Business, and just appreciate having her in this community doing great work. So excited to bring you that conversation with Micah right now. All right, so we're here today with Micah Larson. Micah, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thanks, Justin.
Yeah, so your official title is persuasion scientist, is that right?
That's right, my brand.
That's an awesome title.
Thank you, and it's definitely a good branding choice because it's something that makes people stop mid-conversation and ask about it. So it took me a while to really embrace the brand, but it's great.
Were you workshopping other particular titles or brands?
Because I'm not actually a scientist now. Mm-hmm. I am a business person, but I use science and apply it. So I want to stay connected to the science world, but using it as a brand has been a new adventure. Now my brand is Rogue Persuasion Scientist.
You've added rogue to your business cards?
Yes, on the advice of some of my marketing friends, because it describes what I did. Yeah. I left academia and I'm taking science and applying it to the real world.
Well, let's get into that before we get too much into the banter of scientist and all that stuff.
Yes. But
so you have a background in academia, your master's from Texas Christian University in communications, persuasion, and you tell us about all that. Like, how did you get into this field of communication science?
I think I've always been a little bit obsessed with people and communication. Like, I was the kid on the playground who would not play kickball, one, because I was bad at it, two, because I wanted to sit under the slide and, like, listen to people talk about their relationships and friendships. And so I've always had a brain that I think worked on communication puzzles. And so when I had the opportunity to go to graduate school and study communication as my job, I fell in love with that idea. And amidst the studying of communication, I found persuasion science, or as we call it, social influence. And it really is the science of how we change people's attitudes and get them to buy in.
Right.
So I made that my career.
But, you know, the rogue piece is interesting as part of the brand because, I mean, you tell us about it. Like, when you were a student in Texas at a Christian university, you were studying
sex.
how to get people to use condoms or something like that. Recount that whole piece.
Okay, yeah, I think rogue reflects me as well because...
Yeah, it's definitely the brand.
Yeah, it is. And a reason why I feel comfortable with it is because I kind of marched down to Texas Christian University flying my flag of
Where did you do undergrad and where did you grow up?
University of Missouri. Okay. So I grew up in St. Louis.
So not exactly like, you know, East Coast, West Coast, liberal bastion sort of place. I mean, you were in the heartland.
Yeah, but I was raised by... my mom's a German immigrant and my dad had come from art school in Pasadena, California. And so they are like very international progressive people. And so when I, I marched down to Texas and decided I wanted to study evolution and sex and persuasion at TCU. And I immediately became unpopular.
Right, right. How did you get admitted? What was the story you used to get admitted?
That was, I guess, before they found out how outspoken I was.
Right, right.
Yes.
They thought Micah was a man's name?
Well, that actually has happened to me before. I was recruited for a men's cross-country team in high school because I thought I was a man. So yeah. It wouldn't have been the first time. Yeah, maybe it was the biblical name that threw them off my scent. But yeah, so going rogue in one way was being at TCU and studying something that was kind of flew in the face of what a lot of people's beliefs sure. there were, even in the department. But rogue also meant... I was applying to PhD programs and then took a left turn and decided I'm going to be an entrepreneur instead.
Well, and, you know, for the listener who might not understand kind of that world, I mean, when you're a graduate student, you're being invested in by faculty members, by an institution in order so that you will go get an academic job and sort of promote the legacy of that institution. I mean, that's the path. And almost explicitly, you know, when a graduate student's taken under your wing as a professor, you sort of see that person as, oh yeah, this person's going to be free labor for me for a long time. So to then pivot and go off on your own and not down the academic path, yeah, that takes a lot of guts.
Yeah, it really did. And I think I offended some
sure.
people. However, I was extraordinarily lucky that my mentor didn't care whether I yeah. went into the private sector or stayed in education. He actually used to work here, Adam Richards.
Right.
Now he's an award-winning persuasion scientist and amazing man, and he taught me a lot. And he just encouraged me to pursue whatever made me happy, whether it was research or mm-hmm. applying it in the real world. And he used to work at the National Institute of Health, so he kind of had been... out of academia before.
Yeah. So, okay. So you're doing this study, you know, on sex and condoms or actually let's walk us through. What was your thesis project?
So obviously working on a college campus, people know that sexually transmitted diseases can be a rampant issue and become a larger public health crisis.
Sure.
So, you know, in our best interest to figure out how can we persuade people to adopt really healthy sex behaviors on college campuses. So as a persuasion scientist, my job was to figure out what kind of language works best to mm-hmm. persuade college students to talk to each other before they have sex about, you know, I've been tested, I should use a condom, having those really important facts straight before jumping in the sack, so to speak. So Adam and I studied what kind of language should we use to get people to talk to each other before having sex, but what kind of language actually makes them do the opposite as well. So we know from persuasion science that if we use really forceful language, people will actually end up doing the exact opposite.
Yeah,
of what
reactants, right?
Reactants.
We'll get into all these things,
yeah.
But yes.
Yeah, so we studied inoculation or how we can protect people from being persuaded by their own anger and kind of having that boomerang effect.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll get into inoculation. That's kind of a complicated topic.
It is complicated. Yeah.
But so you do this study, and at what point are you thinking, okay, I want to go out on my own and kind of be a practitioner of these tools?
Yeah, it was because I was really poor. And
yeah, that's an important factor.
Yeah, you know, anyone who's been in grad school knows it's kind of like a ramen noodles type of time.
And your husband, he was in medical school at the time, is that, or what? What
yeah, we were just dating. He was in med school, graduating.
Another sort of delayed path to income.
Yes.
Long
yes.
delayed path.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. We're still on it. So I actually got a lot of people, graduate students take out loans to kind of pay the bills, but yeah. I didn't have the option so much. So I instead got a job in the Texas House of Representatives as a director of communications.
You leave TCU and you go working for a congresswoman from Texas, right?
Yeah.
Or state representative.
State Representative Nicole Collier of District 95. Yes. So it was an amazing opportunity to help craft her message and be persuasive from the Texas House perspective.
Right. And so how kind of welcoming were they of your sort of emerging rogue persuasion scientist brand?
So that was before I had the brand, but it definitely planted the seed in my mind because they were super open to it and they were excited to have someone who came from not a political standpoint, yeah, but yeah, a communication science standpoint, and we're very open-minded to that. And it ended up paying off because people started to try to poach me from her office because I was doing a good job, which was super gratifying.
Right. Good job in terms of crafting messages that were influential, designing outreach campaigns that were moving voters' minds. Is that kind of how your performance was looked at?
Yeah. I actually think my wheelhouse was speech writing.
Okay.
Which is extremely powerful to, you know, she gets up on the steps of the Texas House in Austin and speaks to crowds of hundreds to thousands of people about women's rights. And so it's my job to be the voice there and get people on board, not just to vote, but to get invested in the process of vote of the civic process and get invested in Texas and how politics touch their lives and tell stories. And so that was like creative and science skills married together. And it was remarkable. But my first task ever she gave me was to write a comedy roast.
Interesting.
And that was terrifying because comedy is really hard.
It is hard.
And
I think people think it's easy, but it's exceedingly hard.
Oh yeah. It was definitely the hardest job I ever had there. It was the roast of a 100-year-old black Republican.
Oh geez. Yeah. That's a little fraught.
It went over great. I wasn't actually invited to the event, but, I sweated a lot, I think, when I was trying to write it.
Sure. So you get thrown to the wolves. You kind of have to be innovative, creative, crafty, prove your worth. And then, you know, at what point are you thinking, okay, I'm going to take this show independent and do my own thing?
I actually was kind of in the ends of my master's program, and it was time for me to make a decision. What am I going to do? Threw away my PhD applications and picked up an application for the CIA because I wanted to be a data analyst.
Sure.
And started going through the interview process and made it through a couple steps there. But I come from an entrepreneurial family, and something really struck me about the independence that I would get from leading my own circus, like you said, so to speak. Having only me to check in when I make my own decisions, like having complete freedom, and there's so much responsibility, but I had the naivety and like somewhat ignorance about what it takes to run a business that's necessary to kind of jump on.
I mean, probably some amount of that naivete is necessary to dive in, right, and take that chance.
Because
I think if you had all the awareness of how hard it is, people would probably not do it.
Yeah, yes. And we had an event occur at when I was working in the house. There was a woman in her 20s who was, she suddenly died and was rushed to the hospital in our district. And, her family was saying, can we please take her off life support? And the hospital said, we can't because she's pregnant. So they were kind of keeping her, as an incubator for this baby. And the law said one thing, the family wanted another. Mm-hmm. And, part of my job was to write a statement about how to persuade people in one direction or the other this really sensitive issue. And that's when I started to really grasp how I could apply persuasion science to the real world and swing people's minds one way or the other. I didn't really necessarily want to work on that topic, but I started to see how persuasion can make the world a better place if we apply it in the right spot.
So let's fast forward a bit. So now you're in Missoula. And your company, Apis Communication Science, that's exactly what you do. You work with individuals, you work with companies. Tell us about Apis and the work that you do.
Yeah, so I wanted to take something that's, people are complicated. The persuasion can be complicated. There are a lot of factors that it takes to change people's attitudes and get them to buy in because our brains are complicated. Mm-hmm. But we can all, if we kind of look back at how the brain is put together and what makes people make decisions, we can kind of create a plan for how to persuade people. And that's what I wanted to do. That's what I want to give to people who run nonprofits and own businesses and do cool projects in the world. I want to give them the 1, 2, 3 to here's like the roadmap to persuading people, getting them to buy in. That's what APIS does. So I was living in Wyoming a few years ago and just had one of those lightning bolt moments when I thought, how am I ever going to make it easy for people to learn how to persuade build an algorithm. Duh. Mm. So I built the APIS algorithm, starting by drawing out on huge sheets of paper in my dining room, and eventually turned it into code, and now it's on my website. So basically the algorithm gathers information about a person, the person or people that they would like to persuade, what they would like to persuade them to do. For example, something I used to be interested in researching is organ donation. So maybe someone from a health field wants to persuade the public to become organ donors and sign the back of their licenses. How would they do that? What are the best ways to go about that? The algorithm predicts the best tactics to persuade people.
So can we walk through like a hypothetical example, but one that might have some relevance at least to me. So in some ways, I view class as a, and I'm stealing this pithy phrase from a friend of the pod, Bryce Ward, but sometimes I view class as an advertisement for office hours.
Oh.
Right, that I really want students to come to office hours. Yet many students, either they have no interest, they don't care to come meet me, or they don't have time, or they're unmotivated, or they don't see the value in it. So if I want to persuade students to come to office hours, how would we do that? Like okay, I'm going to go to your website. I'm going to pull up your algorithm and how's that all work?
Yeah, great question. So it's pretty simple. The algorithm is a quiz format now. It's on the landing page of my website. And so all it does is ask you a series of yes or no questions about yourself.
Okay. So what can we role play that? Like if you're the algorithm, which you kind of are, what would you ask?
Okay. So the first questions are, who's your target? So is the person or people you'd like to persuade? It's obviously your student.
Students.
What is your request? So what is it that you'd like them to do?
Come to office hours.
Okay. So one of the most important first questions, is it a group? Is it one person? So obviously it's a specific group of people. And then the algorithm starts kind of down a path of asking a lot of questions of the characteristics of your students and what their motivations are. And then a lot of characteristics of you, which is where it gets super interesting because you're a male, obviously. And that determines what kind of language you should best use to persuade them, what kind of authority you have, what you look like, what mode of communication are you using? Is it face-to-face? Are you writing an email?
Sure.
Is this a social media request? There can be up to 120 questions. And the reason is because the algorithm wants to be smart and it wants to gather as much information about this process as possible to give you the most personalized recommendations.
Okay. So say, yes to mail and in-person class and verbal communication. How do I make students come to office hours?
Okay, so, we'll just go back to something I mentioned earlier, which is the intensity of the language that we should use. So we know that in general, when we use really intense, aggressive language, it can get people, it can actually make them do the opposite of what we want.
So that's reactants,
right? Psychological reactants. That's when our brains are telling us, no, we need to protect our ability to make choices. So rebel and reject and do the opposite. Well,
your sense of freedom and agency is threatened and you react against that.
Yeah, right? Because it's beneficial for us to have agency and be able to make our own choices.
Absolutely.
It helps us survive. So it's a survival mechanism. So when we want to persuade people, we want to get them to buy in but not risk that reactance. But we do know that males that we find very authoritative and physically attractive can use more intense language and can still be viewed as persuasive. So they're kind of, there's an asterisk there.
Okay. Is that part of that concept of bandwidth I've heard you talk about?
Yes.
That people that fulfill those characteristics have a broader bandwidth. You mean the range of words and actions they can use to communicate is more permissible?
Yes, exactly. Broader? Yeah. Bandwidth is super interesting and it's a really great way to inform us and help us understand, well, how can I be persuasive? Bandwidth is basically how much freedom you have in what you can say before you start to violate other people's expectations of you. Because we all walk around with expectations preset about how people should speak to us based on what they look like. You know, are their gender, their authority, their race, even their age. So we all have expectations about how our professors should speak to us and, our stewardesses on the airplane. And once we start to negatively violate those expectations and we go outside of our bandwidth, then we become less persuasive.
Okay.
So in order to be more persuasive, we can either act within our bandwidth or we can expand that bandwidth by helping people believe that we are more authoritative. We have a lot of credibility and that we're very trustworthy.
Yeah, I mean, as you're talking about this, I'm thinking of Donald Trump.
I know. People ask me about him a lot.
Yeah, I mean, why not? Like, he sort of, the facts, I think the record would show that he's proven to have far more bandwidth than one might initially expect.
Yes.
Maybe. Am I applying the wrong concept there?
Well, I think it's actually less about his bandwidth, and he uses so much emotion. Mm. So he's using the right tactic to appeal to his target audience.
Okay.
My understanding of Donald Trump is that the people to whom he is speaking are very much persuaded by emotional appeals. Yeah. And he does use like really emotional language, mm-hmm. a lot of fear. A lot of times fear makes most people reject and rebel and run away, but fear is very persuasive to his target audience.
Right. We could go down a dangerous rabbit hole so probably want to press pause there and go back to something as inane and as boring as office hours, right?
Right. Yeah. Office hours.
Does anybody care about office hours? Maybe that's the whole problem. Like I'm trying to get people to care about it.
I hope people care about office hours. They should, because you're such a valuable resource in their education. Sure. But a lot of students probably think, but I'd rather get a latte.
A New Angle is underwritten by First Security Bank and Blackfoot Communications, two cool companies doing awesome things all over Montana.
Hi, this is Jeff Meese, media technician at the College of Business, and you're listening to A New Angle.
Yeah, that's true. Although, you know, Drum Coffee, friend of the pod, they can come to office hours and get a latte.
No kidding.
You know? Maybe I need to just advertise that.
Yeah. Actually, well, you know, one thing that's really persuasive is incentives. So this is actually something I love to talk to my clients about. So we tend to think that we can persuade people really well with that fear I was just talking about, with negative emotions and threats. However, research demonstrates that in most cases, we're better persuaders when we offer people an incentive. Sure. So it's like the carrot and the stick.
Yep.
We end up using the stick a lot. If you look at a lot of ads and PSAs, like you see a lot of sticks, a lot of threats. Carrots work better because there are two types of incentives. Internal incentives, so those things that give us like satisfaction and acknowledgement and recognition and feeling good about ourselves, those tend to work to persuade people in the long term. And then there's external incentives. So those are like rewards, like a latte or a $100 gift card or a new car or something. And those work really well to get people to buy in the mm-hmm. short term.
Yeah, and the same thing could be framed in multiple ways too. So, you know, to the office hours example, and let's close that example right with this, because probably nobody listening except for me cares about it, I'm sure.
Well, I do.
Okay. Well, N of two. Okay. But yeah, so coming for an office hour visit is 5% of your grade. And if it's framed punitively, like, hey, you have to come to office hours, it's 5% of your grade.
Yeah.
That's kind of a non-starter. But if you frame it like, well, do you want 100% on an assignment that's 5% of your grade? Like, do you want 5 points toward the 100 points for this class? Just show up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that you could layer a lot of easy tactics for this one example. Like, for example, social proof. So that's evidence that we give.
Right, that it's actually valuable.
Yeah. Or that other people have bought into this request.
Right.
So this is one of the easiest examples that we use, like when we give people showcase our testimonials. A friend of mine, Mallory Otariano, she owns a website called Kind Apparel, and she mm-hmm. does something really cool on her website that gives people social proof. And I don't know if she was aware of this, but I actually told her about it today. So when you're cruising her website, looking at her amazing women's sportswear, a little pop-up will come up in the left-hand corner of the website that says, someone just bought this dress.
Yeah.
And so social proof is when we give people evidence that others have bought into our request. And mm-hmm. so in your office hours example, like keeping a public list of people who have come to office hours and gotten that 5% of their grade, that's really persuasive. We tend to be persuaded by the herd. We want to go with what the herd is doing.
Yeah. To a certain extent though.
Yeah, because we want to be unique.
Right.
And we want to be novel. But that's a conscious decision. When we make a lot of decisions subconsciously, because our brains are built to be really efficient. And so if we were to walk around and really think critically about every single decision we made about taking the elevator versus the stairs or where to park, or should I get 2% or skim, our brains would be overloaded. So we make a lot of decisions like turning left or right subconsciously. And so that's where social proof persuades us in that kind of subconscious realm. Once we start making conscious decisions, then that's when we think, well, I want to be novel. I want to be different and differentiate myself. Mm-hmm. So they're both persuasive in different contexts.
Right. I'm thinking of optimal distinctiveness theory, right? And so, I think that's Marilyn Brewer. And each one of us has this notion of what the optimal level of distinction we should achieve. Some people fall herd all the time. They're totally comfortable in that. Other people reject it all the time, and there's everything in between. And so what are some of those, something I hadn't thought of or realized was the falling of the herd piece is automatic in many ways. And then the rejection of the herd is a conscious decision.
Mm-hmm.
So what are some of the things that turn that on and off, that if I'm a herd follower, what are some switches that would turn on my conscious awareness so that I would think, no, I'm going to actively reject the herd here? Does that question make sense?
Yeah. So here's what I know about the sameness versus differentness kind of problem is that it follows our pattern of behavior follows what's called an inverted U shape. And that is kind of like if you turn the letter U upside down. So on one side of this U is follow the herd all the time. The other side is do our own thing all the time. We kind of like the most attractive, desirable place to be is right in the middle. And that's why that top of the U is so high, because most people want to fit in to a large degree and make a lot of automatic decisions and not stick out too much. But when it comes to certain factors that probably have a lot of relevance and meaning, they want to be distinct and differentiate themselves and be really novel. If we think about it evolutionarily, which to me is how we explain most of human behavior, is that it's very beneficial to us to be part of a group and be viewed as part of a group. We get protection and resources and really pivotal relationships from our social group. However, we can attract more attention if we're a little bit unique. So it doesn't benefit us to be an extreme either way. So we have to kind of ride that middle. And it's kind of like, I think when we're trying to decide which part of the U shape to be on, it's like, should I buy those shoes or will people think that I'm super weird? That's one moment where we're struggling with what side of the U shape to be on. Is this haircut too weird or should I do something more low key?
Sure. Okay.
Did I answer your question?
I think so. It was different enough. Let's put it that way.
Okay. Good.
I kind of hit the joke there.
Yeah.
Okay. So you've got this algorithm. What are some of, what's a typical client that comes your way and needs your help, and either through the algorithm or through an in-person engagement, because you do so many different things. I mean, if you go to Micah's Facebook page or YouTube page, I mean, she's got these awesome videos, tons of writing, blogging, your site and your presence online is such a wealth of valuable information.
Thank you.
And people find you through that content, but what are they kind of looking to do often?
My clients are people who tend to be working on marketing and sales.
Okay.
Especially marketing. Okay, because you're a marketing expert. So there are so many moving parts in a marketing campaign, and it takes a lot to make something successful. Mm-hmm. And so for someone who that's not even their primary job and they run a business or, they don't come from the world of marketing, it can be very difficult. And we're always trying to find something that will put us ahead of the curve and help us beat our competition. And so people who are really savvy and really like professional development and want to enhance their skills and do marketing, those are my clients, especially for mid-level businesses. Sales to some extent, but it tends to be people who are into marketing strategy.
Okay.
Because I'm marketing technology. I'm a new way to look at marketing.
Yeah.
And persuasion isn't sales or marketing. It's like an add-on. It's like a way to superpower boost all of that.
Superpower boost. That's pretty good.
But I like to work with people who are doing some kind of socially conscious project.
Yeah. I mean, that's a thread that comes out in your work. You sort of, and that's a criticism of marketing that I sort of try to grapple with all the time is like, do we want to sell more pieces of plastic that are going to end up in a landfill to people that don't need them or can't afford them. Like, no, actually, we want to maybe help people make decisions that are better for them and their own welfare and the welfare of their families and maybe the good of the planet, all those things. So you're trying to maybe affect some positive ends on those dimensions.
Yeah. I think of my friend Blake Nicolazzo when I think of this, because she owns a marketing firm and she really is picky about her clients. She wants to work with socially conscious brands who are, you know, she cares about grizzly bears and reducing plastic, and that's how she chooses her clients. And I'm similar. I choose carefully who I work one-on-one with. And in Missoula, I'm lucky because there's a wealth of people who have amazing ideas in an entrepreneurial setting.
So somebody comes to you and you know, have this notion of, okay, I'm putting a lot of effort and resources into my marketing, whatever. It's not quite getting there. I don't know how to measure it, or like, how do you add that secret sauce to what they're doing?
Persuasion's great because it's super subtle.
Yeah.
It's not a marketing campaign. It's the little nuances that we add on to our sales, our marketing, our emails, our conversations, our ads, our Facebook posts that get people to buy in. So,
yeah, let's give an example. Like, what's an example of a campaign that was just flat that you can give a subtle twist to where all of a sudden you're getting some traction?
I have a client who works in an anti-gun violence area.
Okay.
They're in a difficult position because they have the responsibility they feel when there's a gun violence related incident to kind of make a statement about that.
Sure.
And they don't sell guns, but they're kind of in the business of reducing gun violence. But it's really tricky to put out a statement that isn't like thoughts and prayers and doesn't turn people off, but gets them inspired. And every time we have like a school shooting or all these terrible incidents that we've had in the last few years, especially, we turn to, well, what's the solution? What's the solution?
Right.
I'm not going to share the name of this client,
of course,
to protect their privacy, but I really enjoy working with them on those specific types of projects because it's easy to fall flat when you're just kind of putting out a statement saying, you know, thoughts and prayers, and we want to keep our attention on the family and we feel for those who have been affected, but you also want people to buy into a solution that can fix that.
Right. So like you've got this tent, right? And you can make the people in your tent more agitated, more active, more bought in, but you can also expand the tent.
Yeah.
And some expansion of the tent in problems like these, issues like these, kind of needs to be happening.
Yes. And so I get to help them make these small changes in the statements they're putting out that grabs people and brings them into their tent. And get the public to find a solution to gun violence without it feeling like a sales pitch, because it's not. It's an appeal to people to let's do the right thing. And persuasion doesn't feel like selling. When you're persuaded, you don't know that it's happened.
Right. Right. Okay. So that kind of leads me to this next line of inquiries. You know, I know we can't, you know, you've got sort of client privacy issues, so we can't like sort of break down real world examples in a way, but but maybe we can pick your brain on, you know, you're schooled in the, I don't want to say dark arts, but this toolkit of persuasion. So what are kind of like the top five things that we as parents, as educators, as spouses, as, you know, friends, whatever, children, what should we be sort of aware of as far as our powers to influence when we want to, but also maybe red flags that we should be aware of when people are trying to persuade us.
Yeah. Okay. So a red flag is when you're in a sales situation with someone, or you think that you might be, someone might want you to get out your credit card for some reason. Be aware if you feel like you start to like them a lot more than you think you should for the amount of time you've known them.
Interesting.
Because good persuaders enhance liking. So actually liking of a person vastly even more than how much we like their product is the best predictor of whether people buy
it. It's got nothing to do with whether I want the car or need the car, right?
No.
Just if I like the salesperson.
Yeah, like relationship marketing, right? So good persuaders can read their target and create similarities and associations and enhance
pattern
their liking.
Matching of some kind.
Yeah, synchronizing with them sometimes, yeah. And so if, like, for example, you're going to looking at a car And you are like, at the end of, 20 minutes, you're like, I could be buddy. I could go get a beer with this salesman. Yeah. You're being persuaded.
Interesting.
Yeah. And that's like a car salesman is an overused example.
Of course. Of course. Yeah. It's an easy one to use, but for many reasons.
Yeah. Not to give car salesmen a bad name. Like they do a good job. They can be very persuasive.
Oh, many of us need cars.
Yeah. So that's a red flag. But
So if you feel yourself liking the person in an inordinate amount. So one, that's not a thought that occurs to many of us at any given time. So maybe that's just the rule is like, pay attention to why you're liking this person and if it's substantiated by, more than 20 minutes of experience.
Yeah. And sometimes a feeling of obligation that we ignore. Like a lot of the persuasion tactics that I teach motivate people based on there are natural desire to want to keep our relationships balanced and reciprocate.
Sure, reciprocity, yes.
Yeah, exactly. There are a lot of different reciprocity tactics, but sometimes when you have that like gnawing little feeling of, I feel obligated to give or buy in, you're being persuaded. Red flag. And I'm doing something which is unusual, which is telling you how to protect yourself against persuasion, but I think that's ethical.
Yeah, I think so.
Too. Just as ethical as my job is to help the companies I believe in persuade other people.
Well, it's about making better choices, right?
Yeah.
And there's people trying to persuade us to do all kinds of things. So
all the time.
Yeah.
And it is, like you said, a dark art. People do view it that way. It's not coercion. So when you persuade people, the targets always have the option to say no. And it's not forceful. And persuasion is never like a hard sell or hard close. Mm-hmm. My view is that hard sell and hard closing is ineffective in the long term and unethical because you're using pressure tactics. And I think there's a more efficient and effective way to get people to say yes while allowing them their free will, not making them uncomfortable and being smarter, which is using persuasion.
Yeah. So we went over liking, we went over reciprocity, consent. What are some other kind of tools in the kit?
Did you want to talk about inoculation?
Well, I think, are we ready? I'd like to get to inoculation. I've just been trying to build us to that because it's a complicated concept.
Yeah.
I mean, the concept people get intuitively, like from sort of, being given vaccines.
Yeah.
But walk us through what inoculation and communications is.
Okay. So it is possible to protect people and prevent them from being persuaded in the future. So it's kind of like giving someone's brain a flu shot against future persuasion. So we're just talking about protecting yourself from persuasion. This is a way to protect other people from future persuasion. So when would we use this? Maybe if we want to keep a group of people from being persuaded in the future that they should give in to peer pressure and drink a lot or binge drinking or something.
Sure. Okay, so at some point in the future, my daughters are going to be... I say future. I hope future.
they're little.
7 and 9, almost 9. But yeah, at some point in the future, they're going to be faced with peer pressure oriented decisions. Come to this party, drink this, do this. So yes, that instant, maybe we can build around this example.
Yes. Okay. So you don't want your daughters to be peer pressured into drinking. What you want to do is inoculate them in 3 steps. So the first is... we kind of think about the metaphor of the flu shot. And so we know inoculations work based on decades and decades of research that you give someone essentially very, and this is very simplified, but a little tiny bit of an illness. And so their body builds up a resistance to it. And so when you come in contact with the full-blown version of it, then your body's prepared to fight it off. So in inoculation theory, we give someone a tiny little bit of an argument so that they build up resistance to it.
Okay, to be clear, of an argument, I'm not giving my daughters little sips of booze.
No. No. This is just talking.
Okay.
No drinking. Okay. not alcohol resistance, just persuasion resistance. So you're giving someone a tiny little bit of persuasion so that later on when someone does come and full on tries to persuade them to drink, then they're going to be prepared to fight it off.
So what's an example of the bit of an argument? Like, wordsmith for me, what I would say to them.
Okay. So it's really easy to do in a conversation and they won't know that they're being persuaded necessarily. So you can say something like, okay, in the future, someone might say something to you that sounds like this. Hey, well, Justin, tell me what you think it sounds like to be peer pressured into drinking.
What do I think it sounds like? You know, hey, party going on down at the, I don't know, mine shaft or whatever. I don't know.
Yeah, the mine shaft.
Who knows?
Oh, that sounds awesome.
Up on Sentinel.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, absolutely. So someone in the future, someone might say something that sounds like, hey, it's no big deal. Everybody here's drinking. Like, just, you know, just have a couple. Like, we can call you an Uber, whatever. And so then you're giving them that little bit of persuasion and what it would sound like. But then the next step is you give them a script to fight against that persuasion.
Okay, so that's step two is the script.
Step two, yeah. So first, step one is the threat. So that's what your threat message is. You warn them and then give them what the threat message will sound like. And then the next step is to give them something that's called the refutational preemption. So that's a long word that just says you're giving them basically a script and something to help them bolster their attitude so they won't be persuaded. And so then you give them some kind of information or something to fight back with and say, but you know, binge drinking is actually really bad for your body. And this is what you might say to a 9-year-old or a 7-year-old. And say, you know, when you drink a lot of alcohol, it can be really bad for your body and it can make you, do things that
make bad choices.
Yeah, make bad choices.
That's what we say.
Yeah, I'm not a parent yet. So you would.
You have learned this stuff fast.
I know. I'm about to have a baby. So yeah, I got to speed up my learning. So essentially, you've gone through these three steps, warned your daughter that she might be persuaded, given her the threat message, and then you've given her a refutational preemption. And so you can say some things to prepare her to kind of bolster her attitudes about drinking. And then you've inoculated her. And so there have been a lot of studies, even long-term studies on inoculation. So middle school kids, inoculating them against smoking cigarettes, it's been effective.
Mm-hmm. Very effective.
Yeah, I used inoculation theory in my research. So inoculating people against the reactants, which is a whole much more complicated meta-persuasion thing.
That's episode two.
Yeah. It's fascinating. Not only can we persuade people, but we can persuade them not to be persuaded.
Hmm. That's very meta.
It is.
To get my head around
But
that.
You know what is important to know is that it's my job to know those complicated things. My job is to make it super easy for other people to do it. And I give instructions for how to persuade in, 5 minutes. So you don't have to know how to inoculate people. I'll teach you.
So maybe that's a great way to wrap this up, Micah, is how can people sort of, one, if they found this stuff interesting, how can they learn more about it? But more specifically, how can they learn more about your work and get your help if they need it?
Yeah. So I have a YouTube channel where you can watch me. It's Micah Larsen.
L-A-R-S-E-N.
L-A-R-S-E-N, as my husband would say, E-N, like the Danish people. So yeah, I put up a lot of free YouTube videos because I think this is information people should use. Mm-hmm. However, where you're really going to learn how to be persuasive in about 5 minutes is on my website. So there's kind of three steps to using my Persuasion Pollination Program. Get on the APIS website, take the free APIS quiz, and that's where you learn which tactics you should be using to get people to buy in to your request. Then you can subscribe to my content. So I my feature videos are about 5 minutes long, and they teach you how to use persuasion tactics and how you should apply them in your real life. So I have dozens and dozens of tactics, and they're all meant to be used, in marketing, in your emails, in your conversations, your sales, et cetera. They can be widely applied. And from there, I also have a closed Facebook group, and I'm actually starting really cool webinars. I think by the time this airs, I will have one the next week. So awesome. My first free persuasion webinar is January 22nd at 6 p.m. It's going to be a Zoom conference. And so I'm inviting people to listen in, and I'm going to give persuasion advice and answer questions. And I can't wait to share.
Where's that going to be? Where? How do people sort of log into that and consume it?
Yeah, visit my Facebook page or send me an email via my website. There's a contact page on there, and I'll send you the link. My whole idea is that persuasion is complicated, but it doesn't have to be complicated for you, because I can teach you how to be persuasive in at least one way in about 5 minutes. So it's my job to break it down.
Yeah. Well, you're doing awesome work, important work. We appreciate it. Thanks for coming on and sharing a little bit of your wisdom. And I encourage people to just get out there and take a look at what's going on at APIS and with what Mike is doing. Thank you, Mike.
Thank you, Justin. It's an honor. Thanks.
All right. Hope you enjoyed that conversation with Micah as much as I did. Check out her YouTube channel. Just Google APIS Communication Science and you'll find it. Awesome content, useful content coming out on a pretty regular basis.
Okay, next week, Andrew Seligson and Andrea Vernon. Andrew is the president of Campus Compact, a nationwide organization dedicated to creating service learning opportunities on college campuses. And Andrea is the director of the Montana chapter of Campus Compact. And I think they actually call it the Montana Compact, and we get into that in the interview. So anyway, excited to bring them to you next week. Remember that A New Angle was brought to you by CED, Consolidated Electrical Distributors. By now, you've been listening long enough to know that these guys are big and that they sell pretty much everything electrical you would ever need, but you might not know that they hire a ton of University of Montana students. If you want to learn more about careers at CED, visit cedcareers.com. It's a great website name. Before we go, I want to thank some important peeps. Comzar, Elizabeth Willey, interns, Aspen Runkle, Mason Dow, and Max Gibson. Huge thanks to VTO for the tunes, and finally props to Jeff Meese, our master of all things sound. Before we go, if you have any questions, suggestions, comments, insults, whatever, please email me at anewangle@umontana.edu. Help us spread the word, and be sure to use the hashtag #anewangle when you do. Thanks a lot. See you next time.